shifting focus to the big picture, decoding the market, and cutting through the noise. This is Pree's Perspective. Ruby Hart and Hank Tanner are the co-anchors reporting on the latest issue of Pree's Perspective by commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor, Priyanshu Pree Adathakar. Welcome. Let's look at why it matters.
Welcome to the debate. Imagine you own a business, right? And the federal government passes a law stating you must sell your most valuable assets exactly 7 years from today.
Wow.
Yeah. Regardless of what the broader market looks like at that specific moment. And if you are a single day late or, you know, if you miss a bureaucratic checkbox during that sale, you owe a penalty of $1 million per asset.
$1 million per asset.
Exactly. I mean, it sounds absurd, right? It sounds fundamentally hostile to basic financial planning.
It sounds like a game where the rules are just, well, designed to ensure you fail. And yet, this isn't some theoretical exercise. It is the new operational reality for institutional real estate in this country.
It really is. Today, we are analyzing a massive legislative dam that Washington is dropping directly across the flow of institutional capital. And we're drawing our premise today from the June 17th, 2026, Pree's Perspective Briefing by Priyanshu Adathakar.
Right, Pree's deep dive into this?
Yeah, Pree is a top-tier commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor. And as Pree points out here, the top four lawmakers on housing affordability have officially reached a bipartisan consensus. They've agreed on a bill restricting large-scale corporate ownership of single-family housing.
Which is huge.
Huge. We are looking at a historic structural shift in residential investing.
It is a profound shift. I mean, we're looking at an unprecedented federal intervention into an asset class that, really, for the last 15 years, has been defined by relatively free-flowing capital.
We are. And today, we're debating whether this federal intervention successfully balances protecting everyday home buyers while, you know, intelligently incentivizing new housing supply. Or if its rigid statutory mechanics are going to artificially choke real estate capital markets.
Right, and potentially freeze construction financing altogether.
Exactly. I'll be taking the position that this legislation forces a completely necessary pivot. I mean, it ends the frictionless corporate aggregation of existing homes, a practice that has frankly priced out families, and it correctly redirects those billions of institutional dollars into ground up new supply creation.
And I come at it from a very different angle. While the intent to protect the everyday home buyer is, well, it's noble, the actual mechanics of this bill are draconian.
Draconian?
Yes. I will argue that the mandated enforcement mechanism, specifically the forced divestment timelines and those extreme penalty clauses you mentioned, create unnatural liquidation pressures. These pressures just cannot be logically underwritten by any fiduciary.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to fundamentally destabilize institutional funds, freeze new construction pipelines, and ultimately depress suburban property values rather than save them.
Okay, to truly understand this, we have to start with the historical context, right? And define exactly what is being banned. The source material outlines that the legislation specifically targets large institutional investors, or LIIs.
The LIIs, right?
Yeah. And the bill defines an LII as any for-profit entity controlling 350 or more single-family homes. Because for the last decade and a half, following the 2008 financial crisis, we saw the rise of a highly specific business model.
The aggregation model.
Precisely. Well-capitalized corporate entities systematically outbidding everyday home buyers in the traditional open market for existing scattered-site single-family homes. I mean, they were aggregating existing supply. They were not building new homes.
That's the traditional narrative, yes.
And by explicitly prohibiting these LIIs from acquiring any more pre-existing residential housing stock, the legislation elegantly walls off that existing supply. It leaves those homes for families utilizing traditional mortgages.
Okay.
But crucially, and Prithi makes this point very clear, the bill exempts build-to-rent, or BTR, pipelines. Institutions are still permitted to purchase and build newly constructed single-family homes.
Right, the new supply carve-out.
Yeah, it's a surgical strike. You aren't banishing capital from residential real estate. You are assigning it a new job. You're telling Wall Street, if you want the yield of single-family rentals, you have to build the homes yourself.
I see why you think that's a clean solution. I really do. But let me give you a different perspective, because the reality of real estate syndication is rarely that clean.
Fair enough.
You call it a surgical strike, but industry trade groups are sounding the alarm for a very specific reason. Let's look at the grandfather clause for a moment. Existing portfolios of scattered-site single-family homes are technically protected under the bill.
Yes, they are.
So a fund that already owns, say, 5,000 homes doesn't have to sell them tomorrow.
Right, which provides a necessary cushion. It prevents a panic-induced fire sale.
But think about the downstream economic causality here. Think about liquidity. If an institutional fund owns 1,000 homes in a metropolitan statistical area, and they decide they need to liquidate a tranche of 100 homes to rebalance their portfolio, who do they sell to?
Well, they sell to retail buyers.
But historically, they might sell that portfolio to another institution, right? In one clean transaction. Under this new LII definition, the buyer pool is instantly restricted. Another institution cannot buy those 100 pre-existing homes.
Right, because of the 350 home cap.
Exactly. So the selling fund now has to list 100 homes individually on the retail market. They have to sell to 100 different families.
But that friction is exactly the point of the legislation. Returning those 100 homes to the retail market is the desired outcome.
The outcome might be desired by policymakers, sure. But the friction permanently alters the liquidity profile of the asset class.
How so?
If I'm an LP, a limited partner, maybe a pension fund or an endowment providing the capital to these real estate operators, I rely on the ability to exit an investment efficiently. If you remove the institutional buyers from the open markets, you completely alter how future single-family rental structures must be underwritten. You have turned a highly liquid asset class into a highly illiquid one overnight.
I'm not convinced that illiquidity is a bug here, honestly. I think it's a feature. The era of frictionless corporate aggregation is over.
But
let's follow the capital for a second. When that institution does manage to sell those 100 homes on the retail market, the capital they recover doesn't just evaporate, right? It flows into the exemption. It flows into the build-to-rent pipelines.
Okay, let's talk about those BTR pipelines, because this is where the legislation moves from being merely disruptive to being frankly fundamentally disconnected from operational reality.
Disconnected how?
Let's look at the Senate's proposed forced divestment window, which is really the core of this debate. The statute doesn't just say build new homes. It mandates that investors must liquidate these newly built homes within exactly 7 years of acquisition.
Correct. A legally mandated exit horizon.
I struggle to see how a fiduciary can legally commit LP capital to a project under those conditions. For our listeners who might not, you know, live and breathe fund architecture, there is a massive difference between an open-ended fund and a closed-ended fund.
Right.
In a normal free market scenario, an open-ended fund can hold an asset indefinitely. If the market is strong, they sell. If the market is experiencing a severe credit crunch or a localized economic downturn, they simply hold the asset.
They ride it out.
Exactly. They continue collecting rent and wait for the capital markets to recover before selling. They have operational flexibility.
And this legislation forces them into a strict closed-end model.
Exactly. It removes all operational flexibility. If you are legally mandated to sell a specific house in year seven, it's like playing a high-stakes game of poker, but everyone at the table knows exactly what time you have to leave to catch your train.
That's a good analogy.
Right? They aren't going to give you a fair price. They are going to stall, and they are going to lowball you because the market knows you are a forced seller. You lose all your pricing power.
I acknowledge the poker analogy. Forced selling definitely erodes pricing leverage. I won't deny that. However, I would frame it differently.
How?
Savvy operators aren't going to sit around complaining about the loss of permanent holds. They're going to view this as a predictable, structured pipeline. Yes, it forces a closed-end fund model, but closed-end funds have existed in commercial real estate for decades.
True.
You underwrite the project from day one, knowing you have a 7-year disposition horizon. You plan for it. As Pree points out in this week's perspective, the BTR exemption is the critical pivot point, and smart money is going to adapt to it.
Planning for a 7-year exit in a vacuum is one thing,
But what happens when multiple institutions have BTR subdivisions hitting their 7-year expiration simultaneously in the same suburban submarket?
You mean a localized supply glut?
Yes. Let's say 3 different funds built 200 home communities in the same county in 2026. In 2033, all 600 of those homes legally must hit the retail market at the exact same time.
Mm-hmm.
You flood the retail market with inventory that artificially depresses property values, not just for the institutions taking a haircut on their exit, but for the everyday homeowners living next door who suddenly see their home equity plummet because the market is oversaturated with forced institutional liquidations.
I hear the concern about localized oversupply, but let's address how those liquidations are supposed to occur under the statute, because the legislation doesn't just mandate a sale to the highest bidder on the open market.
No, it introduces the ROFR.
Right. It grants sitting tenants a 30-day right of first refusal, an ROFR, to purchase the home they're renting. This directly aligns with the broader societal goal of transitioning renters into homeowners.
Theoretically, yes.
From an investment perspective, you are essentially pre-baking a potential retail buyer into your operational model. You don't necessarily have to list the home on the open market and flood the MLS if the tenant just buys it.
This is exactly what I mean when I say the mechanics are draconian and disconnected from reality. Let's walk through the actual mechanics of buying a home.
Sure.
A traditional retail buyer, a standard family, needs 45 to 60 days to close a standard conventional mortgage. The banking system simply doesn't move faster than that when underwriting W-2 income, conducting appraisals, verifying down payments, and clearing title.
It is a slow process, yes.
Yet this legislation grants a sitting tenant a 30-day right of first refusal to buy the home.
So you're saying the timeline doesn't match the banking infrastructure?
It's a mathematical mismatch. You are giving someone 30 days to execute a transaction that structurally requires 45 to 60 days in the American banking system.
Yeah.
And furthermore, mathematically, what is the probability that a renter living in a premium, newly built BTR home just happens to have a 20% down payment sitting in liquid cash, ready to deploy exactly when the fund's arbitrary 7-year clock expires?
It's highly unlikely.
I will concede the 30-day timeline is incredibly tight. It's perhaps even an oversight in the drafting of the bill that will need, you know, regulatory clarification down the line.
It absolutely will.
However, institutional operators can mitigate this. If you know you have to offer a 30-day ROFR in year 7, you spend year 6 aggressively partnering with preferred mortgage lenders.
You're putting a lot of faith in property managers there.
You are forcing property managers to become mortgage facilitators.
It's an operational shift, definitely.
It disrupts property management efficiencies entirely. But let's look at the darker side of this. What happens when that 30-day window inevitably collapses because the bank couldn't process the tenant's mortgage in time, or because there was a minor title dispute and the fund subsequently misses its 7-year divestment deadline?
Then we have to talk about the enforcement mechanism.
We do, and it is terrifying.
The penalties are severe by design to ensure compliance.
Severe is an understatement. The statute dictates civil penalties equal to the greater of $1 million per violation or 3 times the purchase price of the property involved.
That is the language, yes.
That is an astronomical asymmetric risk profile. $1 million per house. Let's say a fund misses the disposition window on a small cluster of 10 homes. Maybe there was a prolonged tenant dispute over the validity of the ROFR notification.
Okay.
That is a $10 million penalty. That single administrative failure could wipe out the entire yield of the fund for its limited partners. Again, how does any fiduciary underwrite that risk?
They underwrite it by achieving pristine operational excellence, or more likely, they restructure. And this is something Priest explicitly highlights in the briefing.
The restructuring of joint ventures.
Yes, sophisticated developers are already restructuring their joint venture agreements today. They are segmenting their operational companies from their holding companies to carefully manage that 350 home threshold.
Right.
They're defining exactly what entities are actually subject to the LII restrictions. You adapt your corporate structure to mitigate the risk.
Adapting to bad legislation doesn't make it good legislation.
segmenting joint ventures and creating a labyrinth of holding companies just to dance around a 350-home threshold is exactly the kind of friction that drains efficiency from the market.
I mean, legal structuring is just part of the business.
But it means millions of dollars are being spent on legal restructuring, compliance officers, and risk mitigation rather than pouring concrete and building homes.
But that friction is a byproduct of a necessary market correction. The status quo was yielding an environment where well-capitalized corporate entities were systematically locking families out of the housing market.
Hmm.
The federal intervention was inevitable. The question was never if Washington would step in, but how. By utilizing the LII definition and protecting the BTR pipelines, they've crafted a mechanism that forces a structural shift towards supply creation.
But does it actually create supply? Let's trace the capital flight here. If I am an institutional investor and I see a prospectus for a single-family BTR project that includes a mandatory 7-year liquidation, an unworkable 30-day tenant ROFR, and the threat of a $1 million penalty for a minor compliance error...
You're saying you pass on it?
I am absolutely not going to fund that project. The risk profile is too high for traditional institutional fiduciaries.
So where does the capital go? It doesn't just sit in cash.
It flees the single-family asset class entirely. As Pri's perspective points out, institutional funds will rapidly redeploy capital away from traditional residential aggregation and into other highly lucrative asset classes.
Right, sectors without federal price controls.
Exactly. Sectors that don't have forced liquidation windows. They will move into multifamily apartment buildings. They will pivot into hospitality and commercial properties.
And I would argue that is a perfectly acceptable outcome.
Really?
Yes. The capital redeployment is actually a stabilizing force for commercial real estate at large. Yes, some capital will flow to multifamily and hospitality, but the operators who do remain in the single-family space will no longer be the opportunistic aggregators relying on the lazy strategy of buying up existing inventory and squeezing out rental bumps.
Lazy is a strong word, but okay.
Well, the operators who remain will be highly specialized developers who know how to actually build contiguous 200-home rental communities.
But if capital flees to hospitality or multifamily because the single-family risk profile is artificially inflated by a $1 million penalty clause, then the legislation has entirely failed its secondary mandate.
Incentivizing single-family supply.
Yes, it was supposed to incentivize new single-family housing supply. Instead, it chased the supply creators out of the suburbs and into commercial sectors. This is why critics are desperately pointing toward the House's preferred version of the bill as the only viable path forward.
Ah, the House version, which strips out the 7-year forced resale requirement, correct?
Yes. The House version intelligently removes the ticking clock. It allows for permanent BTR holds. It says you can't buy existing homes. But if you build new ones, you can rent them out as long as you want.
A permanent hold model.
Right. And if that version doesn't gain traction during final reconciliation, the Senate's strict divestment timelines will freeze single-family capital completely.
I disagree that it will freeze it completely. Let's look at the efficiencies gained in pure-play BTR communities. When an institution builds a contiguous 200-home rental community, the property management costs drop precipitously compared to managing 200 scattered site homes spread across 3 different counties.
Sure, the operational economies of scale.
Exactly. You have one maintenance team, one leasing office, unified landscaping. Those massive operational efficiencies generate higher yields, and those higher yields can easily offset the underwriting headaches of the 7-year divestment window.
That assumes you can acquire the contiguous land, secure the complex zoning approvals, and secure the construction financing in an environment where your ultimate exit strategy is federally mandated to occur within an arbitrary time frame.
It will be harder, yes.
The specialized operators you're talking about, the ones who decide to brave this regulatory minefield, they're going to demand significantly higher returns to offset the massive compliance risks.
And how do they achieve those higher returns?
They charge higher rents. The cost of compliance always, inevitably, gets passed down to the consumer. In order to justify the risk of a potential $1 million penalty, operators will have to squeeze maximum yield out of the asset during that 7-year hold period. So the consumer, the sitting tenant, who the bill is ostensibly trying to protect, ends up paying premium rents only to be offered a 30-day window to buy the home at the end of the term, which we've already established they likely can't mathematically execute.
I see the tension there. You are arguing that the cure is worse than the disease.
I am.
But I return to the fundamental premise. A massive concrete dam has been dropped into the river. The water is violently seeking its new channels. The era of frictionless corporate aggregation of scattered site single-family homes is definitively over.
That is true.
That is the bottom line. The asset class is transforming, and success is now strictly defined by new supply creation. Institutions can no longer simply be buyers. They must be builders.
And my bottom line remains that while the era of aggregation is indeed closing, the method of closure matters immensely. The final legislative reconciliation between the strict Senate divestment timelines and the House's permanent build-to-rent holds will be the absolute deciding factor.
It's the linchpin.
It is. That single variable, whether institutions are forced to sell or allowed to hold, will determine whether this intervention successfully spurs a golden age of new suburban construction or if it simply depresses property values by forcing unnatural liquidations and scaring institutional capital out of the single-family space entirely.
The tension regarding that forced 7-year divestment clause is undoubtedly the critical fault line. It means the market is entering a period of profound complexity. For institutional investors, asset managers, and limited partners trying to underwrite the next decade of real estate, the rules of the game are being completely rewritten in real time.
The margin for error has vanished. When the penalty for a misstep is $1 million or 3 times the asset's purchase price, you can't rely on outdated playbooks. You need absolute precision in your legal and operational strategy.
Precisely. To navigate this historic rewriting of capital flows, operators need to follow the data-driven guidance of experts deeply embedded in the mechanics of commercial real estate, like the analysis provided in our source material today.
Right.
You'll have to understand how joint venture agreements must be restructured, and you must have foresight into how capital is redeploying across the broader commercial landscape. Priyanshu Adithakar's insights are essential for that kind of high-level navigation.
The landscape is shifting. The capital will find its path of least resistance, whether that is navigating the new rules of residential development or leaving the suburbs behind entirely. It always does.
It always does. Thank you for joining us on The Debate. We will leave you to consider whether this structural shift will build the neighborhoods of tomorrow or if the regulatory friction will simply dry up the capital needed to lay the foundation. Consider how your own perspectives and perhaps your own portfolios are positioned for the flood.
You've got the perspective. Now it's time to drive the news forward. To ensure you never miss a market shift, tap subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. If today's insights are going to impact your strategy, share this episode with a colleague or investment partner who needs to see the big picture. For actionable guides, newsletter subscriptions, and direct advisor consultation, head over to bearinvestors.com. Thank you for listening. We'll watch the market closely. Until next week.